A bipartisan group of senators is urging President Trump to reconsider his decision to pull all 2,000 U.S. troops out of Syria. The president made the surprise announcement yesterday, and this morning he said it's time for other countries to do the fighting. Joining us now is Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, ranking member on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator, 24 hours later, what are you thinking about the news that President Trump is pulling troops out of Syria?
It's a strategic mistake of the first order, and the way it was done doesn't allow for any thoughtful or careful implementation. It really provides a tremendous advantage to our regional antagonists, the Iranians, the Assad government, the Russians, and it seems to be more impulsive than thoughtful. And frankly, it's going to be reverberating for months and months and months, not just in Syria, but in Iraq, in Jordan, and around the world. I think the value of our military cooperation has been diminished simply because it's now so unpredictable whether we'll stay the course or maintain, you know, support for units that have fought with us.
Why do you say it's impulsive? What do you think led to it?
I think it's a series of issues that had very little to do with the advice of his experts or a rational, thoughtful process. I think the president has reflexively tried to deflect bad news in other areas, such as the sentencing fiasco with General Flynn, by doing something dramatic. And so this was the most dramatic thing he could do. None of this has anything to do with strategy or diplomacy or sound military policy. It's all the president, it's all impulsive, and it's all, I think, going to be very detrimental to our position in the world.
Your colleague, Republican Senator Rand Paul, said yesterday that he's happy to see the president declare victory and bring our troops out of a war. The president has said, you know, we've been putting American troops in danger in Syria, spending too much money in Syria. This is similar, you know, argument to what Democrats said about the need to pull troops out of Iraq, something that President Obama did in 2011. What about those arguments?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the realities of our presence in Syria is our forward defense for the struggling efforts in Iraq to reconstitute a government after the ISIS uprising and to get onto a path of stability and the ability to maintain their own defense. So the irony here is that one of the countries that appears to be making some limited progress now, with our help, international help also, is Iraq, and that all could be flushed down the drain. I think it's interesting to note, in terms of President Obama's removal of troops, President George Bush signed an agreement with the Iraqi government in 2008. Stating that all American forces would be out by the end of 2011.
Right.
President Obama, let's be very clear, wanted to get the troops out, but the conditions he had to deal with were a pre-agreed time deadline established by President Bush, and ironically, not many of my colleagues on the other side were very strongly critical of President Bush, but very critical of President Obama. I think, though, you know, looking back, and again, this is what's so difficult to comprehend. Looking back, I think the withdrawal of those troops clearly led to the rise of ISIS. Our inability to have leverage with the Iraqi government led to the rise of ISIS. And then we had to spend a long and difficult process and with thousands and thousands of Iraqis suffering and American casualties to push ISIS out. Having learned that painful lesson, the president seems to be disregarding it totally. His own nominees, the new CENTCOM commander, testified before my committee that there's still 20 to 30,000 ISIS personnel in Syria. They've been degraded significantly. We're closing in on them. But essentially now we've given them a pass.
Have you talked to the White House, to the Pentagon, about this decision? And do you think that minds may be changed?
As the National Security Advisor called me, Ambassador Bolton, I made it very clear I thought it was a very poor strategic decision with very, very significant ramifications. He did not protest mightily. He just simply communicated. That was the presidential tweet. You know, I think the staff appreciates that not only the immediate consequences, but the long-term consequences of our position in that area. But they essentially are following the president's decision.
That is Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, ranking member on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's look now at those new numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau that show the U.S. population growing at its slowest pace since 1937. Part of the reason, as Americans are aging, fewer babies are being born. So what impact will this have on the economy or politics? William Fry is a demographer at the Brookings Institution. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good to be with you.
So, wow, the lowest growth rate in more than 80 years, just 0.6% bump in the population between this year and the year prior. Is that surprising to you?
Well, it was a little bit. I mean, if you look at all the rest of the economic indicators in the U.S., you'd be thinking everything is moving upward, right? I mean, we have the lowest unemployment rate in a long time, increase in wages, and so it's a little bit puzzling, but I have longer-term answers for that.
Well, I was going to say, in the long term, isn't this something you might have seen coming because boomers are coming of the age where they're leaving us?
Yes, that's exactly the idea. I mean, I'm a boomer. I'm not expecting to leave us very soon.
But others have,
It is the fact that, over the next 12 years, the over 65 population is going to grow by about 40%. And that means all the boomers are going to be moving into that age group. And so what's happening is you have proportionally fewer women in their childbearing ages, more people in the older ages, and that is what's called lower rates of natural increase. Natural increase is the excess of births over deaths. Now, fewer births, more deaths means the population isn't growing as rapidly.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting that last year immigration accounted for 48% of the country's growth. That's up from 35% in 2011. 48%.
Yes. And, you know, we're going to see that even further. The Census Bureau's projections show that in around 2030, immigration will be the dominant part of our population growth. And that's not because we're going to have huge numbers of immigrants coming to the U.S. It's because the other source of growth, which is the births, is going to be going down compared to the higher number of deaths that we're going to see.
And in fact, contrary to a lot of popular opinion, economists look at that and say, thank goodness, because when you have slow growth in a country, you are not having people to take the jobs and keep the economy going.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an issue that we have to be concerned about going forward. Were it not for immigration that we've had over the last two or three decades, we wouldn't have as much growth as we do have in the younger population today. And that would put us in a situation like maybe Japan or Germany or Italy, where they have very high levels of age dependency compared to us. Thankfully, our aging is at a somewhat more reduced rate than those countries because we've had this immigration, which tends to be younger. Immigrants tend to be younger than the population as a whole. And, their fertility is a little higher.
Well, and, you know, again, economists saying good because we need them for the jobs. But not every state had a decline. Maine, for instance, recorded more deaths than births. But then their population overall didn't decline because they saw an uptick in people moving in. So talk about the different ways that the population has affected the states and how that ultimately affects our politics, because it affects ultimately representation.
Yes. I mean, it's still the case that the Sun Belt are still are the states that are growing the most rapidly. I mean, Nevada, Idaho, Utah, and Arizona were the four fastest growing states last year. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with people moving there from other parts of the United States, some immigration to those states. But because people have moved to those states, that makes those populations younger, because movers tend to be younger, and so they get more children, and then immigrants are starting to come to those places, too, from abroad. On the other hand, there were nine states this time that actually lost population. The biggest ones were New York and Illinois in terms of the number of people that they lost, but there were seven other states that also showed declines in their population. But when you see a state like Illinois, which has now actually lost population, not just out-migration, but actual lost population for five straight years and in bigger numbers each year, you know, then that says something about, you know, you need to look into what's going on there, how the economy is changing, why isn't it as big of an attractive state as it had been
right
in the past.
Well, every state has the same number of senators, but representatives get apportioned in the House of Representatives. And according to Brandon Roddinghouse, who's a professor of political science at the University of Houston, states losing a seat would be Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Minnesota, Michigan. States that might gain seats, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, North Carolina. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, Texas, I think, will either gain two or three seats. And they gained three seats last time when the census was taken. So, you know, the growth to Texas, both from migration and immigration and so forth, is paying off for them politically. But a lot of these other states, again, largely in the South and in the West, are making those states more politically powerful, I guess.
Yeah. I can see lawmakers in, you know, Michigan saying, come on, people, let's go, get our population up. William Fry, a demographer at the Brookings Institution on the new census numbers. Bill, thanks so much.
Sure, I really enjoyed it.
And with just 11 days to go until the end of the year, it's worth taking a few minutes to talk about the year in the news and what a year it was. On Monday, we'll look at the international stories with CNN's Christiane Amanpour. But right now, we're joined for the top domestic stories by Jeff Glor, anchor of the CBS Evening News. Jeff Glor, welcome to Here and Now.
It's so good to be here. Thank you, Jeremy.
And as you look back on the year in the news in the United States, 2018, what do you think about the political side of things this year?
Yeah, it was interesting. We traveled quite a bit all around the country, Arizona, Texas, Florida, Missouri, to some of the battleground states before the midterm elections. And in each one of these tight races that we visited, we saw all the Democrats talking about the Affordable Care Act and the issue of pre-existing conditions specifically. At the time, Republicans were made Kavanaugh the issue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Affordable Care Act and what happens to it, huge issue before the midterms, as we saw, and I think we're going to continue to see that next year.
One of the defining events of this year was the February 14th shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 people killed in that shooting, 17 more injured. There's been outrage over mass shootings. Of course, that's not the only one. There have been so many others. A youth-led movement for gun control that led to a national school walkout a month later and the International March for Our Lives in March. Do you think 2018 was a pivotal year for America's relationship with guns?
Every one of these shootings is awful and different in a different way. From the beginning in Parkland, when we got down there, I was struck by how media savvy these kids were. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that they were aware of the power of the impact of their words immediately following this tragedy. And they used that. We sat down with four students who survived just the day after the shooting. Mm-hmm. They all came in their Eagles gear. This is Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High in Parkland, which is the Eagles. They all had different opinions on what should happen politically following this. And they were all very raw, but they were all so well-spoken. And mm-hmm. I think it's remarkable to see and tough to see.
I met somebody in the summer who was a teacher from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas who actually ran into the school while the shooting was going on, ended up saving dozens of people. A friend told me this about this person, and I sort of had to step back and sit there for 5 minutes. Like, what am I going to say to this teacher? I don't know. Do I say good job or what? But you start to think about the amount of people in this country at this point who have been in those situations because there have been so many. I think 40,000 people died of gun violence in the last year.
I asked my son a couple months ago, I said, do you do lockdown drills? And he said, yeah, of course. And it was matter of fact for him, but sort of jarring for me to hear. And don't forget, following the Parkland shooting in Florida, new laws were passed in one of the most gun-friendly states in the country. You have to be 21 to buy a rifle now. It's a 3-day waiting period on gun sales. Makes more money available on mental health services mm-hmm. in that state. So that was notable.
Another thing that we have to talk about this year is natural disasters, climate change. The U.S. was hit by some major hurricanes. Hurricane Michael ravaged the Florida panhandle in October. It was the most intense hurricane to hit the mainland United States in decades. Hurricane Florence battered the Carolinas for days. All these disasters happening with the U.S. deeply divided over the threat of climate change.
Here's what was fascinating about these storms. I was in the middle of both Florence and Michael. Florence, we knew about days in advance that it was coming, and it only hit as a Category 1. I say only because it doesn't sound like it was that bad, but it just sat there for so long and dropped so much water, and it was so devastating for so many folks. But we got so much notice on that. Michael was the one that just picked up speed so quickly toward the end there and almost became a Category 5, third largest hurricane to ever make landfall in the United States. And so, yeah, we are seeing these hurricanes and other climatological events that are becoming more extreme. Why is that happening? We're looking into that more as we approach this new year, but it's something that we certainly saw in 2018.
Well, you were also in California after the deadly wildfires there while they were going on. 88 deaths in the state's deadliest and most destructive wildfire ever. Do you think that the debate over climate change has shifted in this last year, that people see the impacts?
I was in California three times this year for wildfires. That's the most ever. The campfire you're talking about specifically, the deadliest and most destructive in California history. There's still people missing. We heard person after person describe that as hell on earth, how quickly that moved. They call it, you know, the extreme fire behavior. And these fires that when they're whipped by these winds can just jump so dramatically and move so quickly that sometimes even if people receive warnings, they can't get out.
You mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, and I want to talk about that because I went down to Washington to anchor our coverage on NPR of the Blasey Ford Kavanaugh hearings for 9 hours straight. A number of NPR stations had to bring in extra servers to handle the demand for live streaming. People were paying very close attention as the Me Too movement kind of culminated in that day. Eventually, Kavanaugh was confirmed. What do you think that whole thing did to this country?
There were a couple days this year where I think a lot of us felt we were witnessing history, and the Kavanaugh hearings were one of them. I felt that way during George H.W. Bush's funeral, felt that way during the Singapore summit, I think, too. But the Kavanaugh hearing, it was so raw and it was so riveting and in many ways so uncomfortable to watch for so many people. Yet I think a lot of people just couldn't pull their eyes away from it. And that is Christine Blasey Ford talking in the morning and how powerful her testimony was. Mm-hmm. And then Brett Kavanaugh coming in. It was a defining day for this country.
It could have gone either way, really. I don't think anybody knew it at that point.
I think so. I saw someone say, one of our colleagues in the middle of the coverage after watching the Ford testimony say, after she was finished, and said, there's no way he's getting confirmed. Mm-hmm. And then after they watched Kavanaugh, they said, there's no way he's not getting confirmed. It was sort of that powerful, I think, on both sides. And I think there were a whole lot of ways to look at it, but it certainly became an enormous, enormous political conversation topic in the elections immediately following.
You mentioned George H.W. Bush. We also lost John McCain this year. It seems like two people who represented a politics that doesn't really exist anymore in Washington.
Yeah, there's not a lot of talk the way we see it from what we saw it from John McCain and certainly George H.W. Bush. That's something that I think a lot of people are reflecting on right now, and the tone of the conversation, and have been for a couple of years now. That said, even though the rhetoric is heated and we see these highly unusual Oval Office conversations, for example, between the president and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, things do actually sometimes get done. The Senate passed a farm bill, 83-17. Criminal justice reform is moving forward. It looks like this partial shutdown is not happening. So I think there's also a couple ways to look at that.
What is a conversation that you've had in the last year? And you've mentioned you've been in California and in Florida and in all these places where the big news is happening. What is a conversation that you've had in the last year that really just stands out to you that you'll always remember?
Well, I think a lot of people are, you know, we talk about the stories that we're continuing to follow as we, you know, we put a bow tie in 2018, but we know a lot of these stories continue on into 2019. And I do think the Robert Mueller's investigation is certainly going to be a continuing topic, especially with the postponing of Michael Flynn's sentencing into at least March, which indicates that that's nowhere near over. In 2018, five of the president's close associates pleaded guilty in deals with a special counsel. Remember, Jeff Sessions, of course, forced to resign in November, in large part because of how the president felt about how he handled all that and his recusal. So I think if you're picking something that, people end up wanting to talk about or want to know what you know about at a cocktail party or wherever else, or uncomfortably at the family dinner table, it might be that.
Do you talk about the news at the family dinner table?
I don't.
After all this? No, you don't.
No, it's kind of cool. My kids have they really don't know what I do, or if they do see it, they think it's like a second Jeff Glore or something. They'll say, or a second daddy, which is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to, when I'm home, I try to be dad entirely, and I think it works.
I take my dog for a walk in the morning every day before work and start with music, because if I start by listening to the news, I'll just get annoyed after 10 minutes and you have to have a little bit of a break.
You're absolutely right. And I'm conscious of it too when we're programming the broadcast for the evening and what we're putting on, because I remember sitting around the dinner table when I was a kid and we'd have the evening news on. And so some of this stuff is tough. And, we certainly have to cover it, and we can't shy away from things. But I do think there are ways that we can cover the news that make it something that people can learn from, too.
Mm-hmm. That is Jeff Glore, anchor of the CBS Evening News. Jeff, thank you so much. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. And really appreciate you joining us.
Same to you, Jeremy. It's so good to be with you.
If you're a parent finishing up your Christmas shopping and you're looking for a toy with some staying power, you might want to check out the Toy Hall of Fame at the National Museum of Play. All 68 honorees are iconic toys that have stood the test of time, including the three oldies but goodies that made the list this year: the Magic 8-Ball, the card game Uno, and pinball. Michelle Parnett is a curator at the National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. She joins us on Skype. Michelle, the judges chose the inductees from a field of 12 finalists. How did they make their selections?
So we have very specific criteria. We look at icon status, longevity, discovery, and innovation. This year we've received almost 2,000 nominations.
Wow.
For 400 different toys. And we announce our finalists after heated debate in November.
Okay, and one of them is the Magic 8-Ball, which has actually been a finalist for the Hall of Fame 7 times. What do you think put it over the edge this year?
I think that it finally deserved its chance to be in the spotlight, and people recognize that. And I think that people are more comfortable with fortune telling really just being harmless and fun play. You know, you think about the Magic 8-Ball or the Ouija board, and people think it's a little bit taboo, but it's just fun.
Do you think that the Magic 8-Ball knew that it was going to be an inductee?
I'd say signs point to yes.
Signs point to yes. Okay. The next one that made the list this year is the game Uno, which we've all played a million times. What do you think put this one over the top?
It's been on the list 2 times as a finalist. I love the idea that it's something that your whole family can play. It's been around since 1971, and it's affordable, and it's available to nearly everybody.
And it's not that hard to play either. You don't have to spend a long time reading the instructions and all that.
No. In fact, a colleague down the hall said his 4-year-old son beats him almost every time they play together.
Okay. And then the last one is pinball. This is a game that has been around since the 1930s but has made a digital comeback in recent years. What do you think gives pinball such staying power?
I think it's that it's very social, and also it's competitive, but in a very fun, good-natured way. And they always bring out new licensed versions, which really helps to give it stability.
What were some of the ones that did not make the cut?
So this year, our finalists also included American Girls, Chalk, Chutes and Ladders, Fisher-Price Corn Popper, Sled, Tic-Tac-Toe, Tickle Me Elmo, and Tudor Electric Football.
Chutes and Ladders was a fun game. I remember that.
It is. And it was actually the first time it's been nominated as a finalist, which really surprised me.
Wow. What about Monopoly? I'm sure Monopoly is on your list.
Oh, yeah. Monopoly is on our list. And the museum actually has one of the oldest versions of Monopoly on display. It's really magical.
How often do you play games?
I would have to admit I do not play games very often.
Really? It's like feels like work to you to go home.
It
and play
does.
Games.
It does. And I have a 2-year-old at home, so I'm mostly playing with whatever he's interested in.
And what is he interested in any games yet? Has he learned Uno? Can he beat you at Uno yet?
No, he's not quite there yet.
That is Michelle Parnett, who's a curator at the National Museum of Play, talking about this year's inductees to the museum's Toy Hall of Fame. We will have a list at hereandnow.org. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
About 100,000 Holocaust survivors live in the U.S. today, all of them over the age of 70. Their numbers are dwindling. Anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial are on the rise. So will they be remembered? Well, enter John and Amy Pregelman. The Denver couple has made it their mission to photograph as many Holocaust survivors as possible, more than 700 so far, before it's too late. Here now's Karen Miller-Metzen joined them on a photo shoot and has our story.
3 years ago, John Pregelman was commissioned to photograph Holocaust survivors for an exhibit at an Illinois Holocaust museum. For him, the project was life-changing.
So I went there and took 65 photos in 3 days and became absolutely enthralled with their attitude, their outlook, and their amazing things they've done in their life.
John couldn't stop thinking about the survivors and their stories. So instead of putting away his camera, he committed to meeting and photographing as many of the country's survivors as he could. He and his wife Amy set up a not-for-profit called Kavod.
Kavod means dignity, honor, and respect, and every person deserves that.
The organization is based in Memphis, and John not only photographs Holocaust survivors, but also helps survivors in need. On the day I meet up with them, John and Amy are at the Orchard Cove Independent Living Center in Canton, Massachusetts, with 3 survivors who live there. Hi, nice to meet you.
I'm Esther Adler. I was born in Germany.
My name is Edith Barth. I was born in Vienna, in Austria.
My name is Trudy Schwartz. How are you? I was born in Stuttgart, Germany, and after the war, I came to this country.
The women sit in a semicircle in one of the center's living rooms. John sits on one end, Amy on the other. I ask how it feels that so many years after the war, someone they don't know wants to photograph them and hear their stories. Edith Bard is the first to respond.
Well, the main thing is that my parents were killed in a concentration camp in Poland in 1942. So anything that concerns the Holocaust is certainly very close to my heart.
Here's Esther Adler.
My childhood, my youth was not growing up in a family, so this is my life. I see living here in Orchard Cove, which is a retirement community, that people obviously getting older and older or sicker and sicker and they die. And some of them were survivors. And with every survivor, and especially one who I was very close who passed away recently, it feels like some piece of me is lost.
Trudy Schwartz pauses before trying to articulate what having her picture taken means to her.
I guess a perpetuation, a memory of all the things that happened. It's important to document the people who survived.
The 3 women, not a walker or a cane in the group, spring up to get ready for their second photo shoot of the day. They laugh a little, comparing themselves to models, and walk over to the sofa on the other side of the room.
We'll do some more, and I'll start with Trudy.
John Pregelman begins taking photos.
I try and capture, and it's usually just from the waist up, their personality. So basically, I take maybe 50 to 75 photos of each one, and then after I'm done, I look at all of them together, and I pick 6 or 7 or 8 of the better ones. It's such a privilege to hear them tell their stories and we feel their strength and their determination, especially these 3 ladies who are all in their 90s.
Actually, I didn't ask you how old you are because you all seem youthful, but can you give me your ages?
I'm 95.
94 going on 95. She's 6 months older, but I forgive her.
I'm 99.
You're 99. I wouldn't have said a day over 80. Kavod gives the photographs only to the survivors and their families and to the local organization that helps arrange the photo shoot. There's no gallery, no exhibition, no fanfare. Some of the photos are posted on Kavod's website, but the only full display is on John's office wall. It's covered with pictures, ceiling to floor, each a personal history. Amy Pregelman says John develops a relationship with each survivor he photographs.
Not only does he take the photos and spend time hearing their stories, but each individual person receives a handwritten note from him with their photo. So just so that's a beautiful connection that he makes with every single one.
Those connections are what led to the charitable arm of the organization.
One particular time in Orlando, I was taking a photo, and invariably, after I take the ladies' photos in their home, they want to give me something to eat. So we went into her kitchen, and she opened her refrigerator, and there really was nothing there. And she said, well, this month I ran into an expense I didn't expect, and I had to spend my grocery money to take care of it. And so I just do without.
After that visit, John and Amy did some research and found out that about a third of Holocaust survivors in the United States live below the poverty line. That's about 35,000 people. They partnered with Jewish Family Services to find out who needed help with rent, with food, after a hurricane, or with a medical expense.
All we need to know is, are they a survivor? What's their situation and how much do they need? They don't have to prove any financial need. We don't need anything except that they're survivors.
The money comes from private donations, anywhere from $18 to a few thousand, and it's given to survivors mostly in the form of gift cards to grocery stores or pharmacies. That helps give recipients dignity, or kavod. After the photo session, Trudy, Edith, and Esther sit back down on the sofa. It's been a long day sitting for photos and reliving wartime memories. Still, Edith Bard has more to tell.
I want to tell you about Kristallnacht because I was there in Kristallnacht.
Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938, the night of broken glass, when Nazis in Germany torched synagogues, vandalized Jewish homes, schools, and businesses. In the aftermath of that night, 30,000 Jewish men were captured and sent to concentration camps.
So there was a rumor going around, they're going to wind up all the Jewish men. So my father did not sleep home. So at night there was a knock on the door and three men came in. And they were looking for men. There were no men around. So they looked at me. I was 14 years old at the time. And they said to me, you come with us. So my mother said, take me instead. And they didn't want to listen. She said. So I was scared. Didn't know what's going to happen to me. So we walked outside. The first thing I saw was the flames in the distance. They were burning down the sand synagogues. Then I saw a bunch of men already walking down the sidewalk. Later on, I found out they were going to Dachau. There was a race to go to Dachau. So they handed me a pail of white paint, and they took me to the Jewish stores where I was supposed to write Jude, which means Judah, you know, and the Star of David. So after the whole night of that, they poured the paint over me. I always remember that the white paint was left. I had a nice coat on, paint all over me, and they let me go home. And after that, of course, life was altogether different.
Again, Trudy Schwartz.
You know, you grow up and you think you live there forever. You're part of this country. And then all of a sudden, you're a stranger and you get thrown out. So it's sad. It's upsetting. And, you know, it's something that you'll remember for the rest of your life.
Here's Esther Bard.
So much history, and it shouldn't be forgotten. And those of us who are still around, whether you call yourself survivor or not, we can testify and talk about it.
John says he sees a transformation in the survivors from before they sit for a photo session to the moment they receive their pictures.
It really gives them a sense of dignity and worth and happiness to know that there's people who are going to remember them, because their biggest fear is that they'll be forgotten.
For Here and Now, I'm Karen Miller-Medson.
And Amy and John will be taking pictures in Boulder, Denver, New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Florida in the coming months. In most of those cities, they'll also be doing Holocaust education outreach in schools and community centers. For more information about Kavod, to see pictures, and to hear more about Edith Bard's experiences on Kristallnacht, go to hearnow.org.